Podcasting from the Deep Sage 9 Observatory in the high desert near Taos, New Mexico, this is the Deep Sage 9 Starcast. Welcome to the Starcast for the week of June 15th, 2025. I'm your host, Jay Schaefer, and with me is my co-host, Mike Lewinsky. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks, Jay. It's great to be here.
Let's take a look at space weather from spaceweather.com. Mike, what's happening with the sun over the next couple days?
Well, we've got a group of sunspots that are facing the Earth now, and there is a good chance, 40% chance of M-class flares, and even a 5% chance of X flares this weekend. In fact, I hope to get my C-star out and image the sun after we get off the call here. As far as our geomagnetic storm forecast, here at the mid-latitudes, we have about a 40% chance of an active magnetic storm in the next 48 hours with minor probability of 25 to 30% and a severe storm probability of just 5%. And as I was looking at the forecast, I noticed that the high latitudes have a much lower likelihood of an active condition, but a much higher likelihood of a severe condition, 60 to 65% at high latitudes. And that puzzled me a little bit. Why would our active be at 40%, but the high latitudes only be at 10%? It seems counterintuitive.
Yeah,
do you have any thoughts?
Actually, it's a scale. So in other words, you know, active would be, you know, a certain amount of activity, and minor is, you know, more activity. And so severe would be, you know, lots of activity. So what they're basically saying is that, you know, it's a very low chance of it being low activity, and it's very high chance of it being very, very active.
And okay, so that makes sense.
You know, so it's a scalar thing. And so that, you know, that's at least how the way I understand it. So let's look at some of the other things that are going to happen this week. We've got Monday evening after sunset, you can look west and see the red planet Mars, and it's going to be very close to a blue-white star called Regulus, which is one of our brighter stars. And the pair will be just above the horizon until midnight local time. And then, of course, it will set. And then Wednesday is our last quarter moon, which I always, you know, kind of welcome, is that period between the last quarter and the first quarter moon, which is the time for the best observing, of course, is, you know, over the new moon period. And then so Thursday morning, maybe look before sunrise, look for Saturn and Neptune. It'll be just a few degrees from the moon, which will be, of course, a halfish moon. And you'll see Saturn, but you'll need binoculars to pick out Neptune. And, you know, personally, I've never been able to really make sure that that's exactly what I was seeing through binoculars. You know, and Neptune is pretty pretty dim in relation to something like, of course, Saturn. And then Friday, of course, is our solar solstice, summer solstice. And it's the longest day and the shortest night of the year. But that's not to say that it's the earliest of the sunrises or the latest of the sunsets. And so those actually occur on different different days. But it's, but overall, that what the, our solstice, of course, is the longest day and the shortest night of the year, at least here in the Northern Hemisphere. So those are the main events in the sky this week. For this week's discussion, we're going to talk meteors.
Yeah, that's right, Jay. Meteors, meteoroids, meteorites, meteor showers, bolides. Why do we need so many different terms anyway? And do the color of meteors tell us anything about them?
Yeah, so I'd like discussed this in an earlier podcast a little bit, but I can go into a little bit deeper dive here. Is when we talk about meteors and meteorites and meteoroids, a meteoroid is a meteor that has yet to enter our atmosphere. And so, and then a meteor is a rock or pebble from space, or even a grain of sand type sized material from space that is entering our atmosphere and usually burns up. And if it burns up very brightly and explodes in the atmosphere, that's what we usually call a bolide or a fireball. And then if it actually makes it to the ground and strikes the earth and sits there on the ground, that's a meteorite. And so a lot of people make the mistaken statement that, oh, I saw a meteorite last night. Well, you probably saw a meteor, but if you do see a meteorite, let me know, because they're actually there are some meteorite hunters. They're worth quite a bit of money, and of course there's consensus among the scientific community that they would rather not see meteorite hunters out there doing this as a for-profit business. They would rather that if you find a meteorite, that you turn it into your local university so that scientists can actually study those. And so, of course, the more we can see with meteorites, the more we can learn about meteors and therefore meteoroids and therefore about things floating around in space that aren't planets or stars. So you asked about the colors of meteors, and does that tell us anything about them? Well, it does talk about the chemical composition of what the meteor is. And so meteoroids can be a couple different things. Is that while it's in space, a lot of the meteoroids are basically the remnants of comets that have passed our Earth's orbit. And so there might, you know, the ice and rock or whatever, you know, kind of the old dirty snowball analogy for what a comet is that it's basically dirt and ice left over from comets that pass through the Earth's orbit. And then some other types of meteoroids are actually from asteroids. And so the asteroids are rocky pieces in space, whether it be like a minor planet like Ceres that orbits between Mars and Jupiter, or, you know, just some errant rocks that are pieces of either protoplanets or planets that are broken up, or other asteroids that are broken up. And so that material is rocky material, and so it's a different chemical composition when it hits our atmosphere than, say, a comet remnant. And so to get into this a little bit more deeply is that if you see orange-yellow light from a meteor trail, that's usually from its makeup of being sodium, and it's sort of just like the sodium vapor lights that you see over parking lots, you know, that kind of that orange yellow light that you get from that. And then if it's kind of a brilliant yellow light, that's usually from iron atoms. And then magnesium is a kind of a blue green light. And then ionized calcium may add a purple hue. And then, of course, when a lot of times when they're going through the atmosphere, they're actually exciting the molecules in the atmosphere. And so nitrogen and oxygen atoms in our atmosphere give off a red light from the meteor. So meteor color kind of depends on whether or not the metal atom emissions, so that basically glowing atoms, like the, you know, when we talked about the sodium vapor light, or air plasma emissions dominate. So that kind of determines the color of meteors. So, you know, we're kind of not going to see too many meteor showers this month. June is usually kind of a bust, isn't it?
Yeah, there's just one notable meteor shower this month, which are the Butids, originating or appearing with a radiant in the Butes constellation, and originating from a comet called 7P Pons Winnecke. Most years, this is a barely noticeable meteor shower, but every once in a while, it does put on a good show. In 1998, there were reports of 50 to 100 meteors an hour, so maybe more than one a minute, maybe almost as many as two a minute. In 2004, there were 20 to 50 meteors an hour, which is still a pretty nice rate. There was expectations that 2010 might have had an outburst, but there were fewer than 10 meteors an hour that year. Still, we can hope, right? This year's expected peak is the night of June 26th to 27th, which is the night after the new moon. So if there is an outburst, we should have good dark sky conditions with no interference from the moon that night.
Okay.
Jay, you operate a meteor camera, don't you?
Meteors have always been, definitely one of the things that I've been most interested in. And at the quote-unquote observatory here, the Deep Sage 9 Observatory, I have an all-sky camera, which captures the entire sky every night, so that basically, hopefully, I never miss anything. But, but that, by covering the whole sky, that doesn't have a whole lot of resolution. And so I found out about the Global Meteor Network, which is a network of cameras across the entire world. And this was founded by a gentleman by the name of Dennis Vita, who's actually a paid scientist and an investigator, and he's wrote several papers on meteor detection and being able to trace meteors back to their source and that sort of thing. And so he founded this Global Meteor Network and invented this and worked with some people to invent some software and these cameras that to basically look at a portion of the sky. So my field of view on this camera is basically 90 degrees in width by 45 degrees in height as far as its field of view. And it's a very sensitive camera, and the software records the entire night of wherever the camera is aimed, and then that software actually figures out how many meteors there were and what their trajectories are. And it's pretty sophisticated software, and it's kind of a DIY situation where you can build your own Global Meteor Network camera and software and run the software on a small computer like a Raspberry Pi. And then the entire network is basically interlinked. And so if you go to the globalmeteornetwork.org, I believe it is, you can actually look at all the data from that particular night. And then here in the U.S., we've kind of got a sub-network that's called the New Mexico Meteor Array, which is headed by Peter Eshman here. And this is more of a kind of regional network of cameras where we've kind of deployed from everywhere from Colorado to Arizona and New Mexico. And we have a fairly dense array of these cameras, and so we get really good data on meteors every night. And you can actually see the archive of my meteor camera at skylapser.com, and you can look at the previous night and see just how many meteors were detected, and it's got some pretty fascinating data.
Yeah, that's awesome. I really hope I get a chance to build one of those one of these days. I have a bunch of links up here and I've got some Raspberry Pis, so it's not out of the question. In fact, I've got some cameras for Raspberry Pis, so it's mostly a matter of getting power outside, probably with power over Ethernet injector into a place that's suitable for me.
Yeah,
And of course,
that's right.
housing and heater equipment.
Yeah, this is just basically a modified security camera that you can order from Alibaba, and it's specifically kind of set up as a monochrome camera, and it's basically blows out during the day, but it's very sensitive during the night. So some of the things that you introduced me to from your time lapses of meteors is one of the things was these persistent ion trains that meteors leave behind. And when I first saw that, you'd introduced me to it from your time lapses, and then now since then, that's one of those kind of holy grail things that when I see a meteor. Can you talk a little bit more about those ion trains that meteors leave?
There's so many aspects of meteor science that we could probably talk for an hour and not cover everything. But ion trains are, I think, a really fascinating part of this. When a meteor enters the atmosphere and becomes a meteor that we can see, it's traveling at a pretty high rate of speed, and the collision of the body of the meteor with the atmosphere starts to strip electrons off of the atoms in the path, and also to strip electrons off of the meteor itself. And so, when that happens, that's a process called ionization, where you have a atom that is missing an electron, and in the process of gaining its electron back, we're frequently creating an emission of light. And so, both the disintegrating meteor and the atmosphere that it's disintegrating in are losing electrons and becoming ionized, and that's the ion trail. And so, what we see when we see a glowing train that persists is those atoms that are excited and are acquiring electrons and emitting light that we can see. And there's all kinds of really interesting stuff that happens as a result of this process. It was noticed back in the 30s, I believe, that radio signals will bounce off of the ion trails. And there is something called meteor burst communication, or MBC, sometimes also referred to as meteor scatter communication, that allows for radio stations up to 2,200 kilometers or 1,400 miles from each other to reflect signals between stations by bouncing them off of those ionized trails of meteors. And the thing is that we're having thousands of meteors hitting the Earth every day, and so that ionization is up there almost continuously. And this is such a phenomenon that it has been used by the military and federal government for long range communications. NATO established a deployment called COMET, or acronym for Communication by Meteor Trails, to use for long-range communication in Europe. with stations in Netherlands, France, Italy, West Germany, UK, and Norway, and able to transmit between 115 and 310 bits per second throughout the year. Not a high rate of communication, and satellites eventually displaced a lot of this use. Additionally, the United States Department of Agriculture has used Meteor Scatter for communication with over 900 gauging stations in the western United States to transmit data about snow water content. And so we had an extensive, for 40 years, an extensive network of remote transmitters that relied exclusively on Meteor Scatter communications to send measurements of snow water content back to a data center. So, and ham radio operators use these all the time to communicate with each other. And so, especially during meteor storms or meteor showers, and we might mention a distinction there between a meteor shower and a meteor storm, the latter being much more, where we might be seeing hundreds and hundreds of meteors an hour, or even thousands of meteors an hour. Meteor storms are very rare and not as predictable as meteor showers. But so in addition, the persistent ion trains also contribute to a phenomenon known as noctilucent clouds that appear at high latitudes. And this is a phenomenon where the disintegrating meteors are creating nucleation sites for very high altitude ice crystals. They're dark and they appear to glow and often described as an electric blue color. And they tend to show up in the spring. They have been observed as far south as Colorado and Utah. In fact, I thought I observed noctilucent clouds last year. I did not was not able to confirm, but it certainly struck me something unusual. In that it was actually in the pre-dawn after sunset.
They appear more in the summertime in the northern hemisphere, simply because of basically that moisture can get to those high altitudes.
Yeah, and they're appearing more frequently and at lower altitudes is telling us something about climate change, that methane is, and we'll include a link to this in the podcast, methane is reaching the troposphere, where it, through a series of chemical processes, turns into a couple molecules of water. Typically, water doesn't get that high up in the atmosphere, but methane can. And then when it becomes water, it forms the basis for more noctilucent clouds in more areas than have previously been observed. And so we do know that methane is a significant greenhouse gas, and the more frequent appearance of noctilucent clouds and at lower latitudes tells us that the methane is accumulating and having a big impact on the Earth's atmosphere.
Wow. Meteors and global warming or climate change all in kind of one paper. That's very interesting. I think we're going to run out of time here soon. Hopefully we enlightened the people a little bit more about meteors in general. And so we'll go ahead and thank all of our listeners for checking out this podcast. Be sure to comment, like, and subscribe, and let us know what you'd like to hear more about or less about, if you feel so inclined. You can also check out our websites at wildernessvagabonds.com and skylapser.com. The intro music is Fanfare for Space by Kevin MacLeod from the YouTube Audio Library. From the Deep Sage 9 Observatory, this is Jay Schaefer and Mike Lewinsky wishing you all clear skies.